950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, Matt McNeil. Craig B. Upright has got a brand new book out, Grocery Activism, The Radical History of Food Cooperatives in Minnesota. He's an associate professor of sociology at Winona State University, and he's got a PhD from Princeton, spent more than a decade working in the restaurant industry, including 4 years as the owner of the small coffee shop in St. Paul. He's kind enough to join us today to talk about the book. Hi, Craig. How are you?
I'm doing great, Matt. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much. I appreciate the time. I'll start by asking how this is. It's a very interesting element of industry in this the rise of the co-ops and the change that happened within the co-ops in the 1970s. What got you initially interested in this topic?
As you mentioned, I have spent or had spent several years in the restaurant industry before. Discovering sociology and deciding to go to graduate school. One of my chefs was Lenny Russo over at the Lauren Cafe, and he later opened up Heartland Restaurants. And he was trying to source local and organic food as much as he possibly could. When I decided to go to graduate school and go into sociology, I wanted to study the organic food movement in greater depth. So as I was doing my research, the cooperatives kept coming up again and again, and I realized you can't tell a story about organic food without going into the cooperatives, and that became a big enough story that's what I decided to focus on, was cooperatives, and especially how these two different movements, cooperatives and organic food, found each other and helped create this very powerful partnership throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Cooperatives are not something new. Reading from your book, in 1752, Benjamin Franklin founded the first formal cooperative organization in the colonies, the Philadelphia Contributorship for the Insurance of Homes from Loss by Fire. Cooperative, they need to work on that name. Cooperative business ventures began in the early 1800s, various industries. Dairy cooperatives. My parents, my grandparents, there was dairy cooperatives all around, cheese cooperatives, as well as hog slaughtering and marketing as well. The cooperatives, it seemed to be a reaction. These early cooperatives were a reaction to, kind of almost a political social crisis at the time to ensure that there seemed to be, that the local people were being taken care of. Is that a fair way to describe it?
I think that it is. Over the last 200 years, there have been lots of attempts to try to kind of navigate the uncertainties of true free market capitalism. I don't think that true free market capitalism actually exists outside of theory.
Yes.
But certainly, government regulations exist to help smooth some of the choppy waters that are out there. And cooperatives are part of that response as well. One of the theorists that I ran across while doing this research suggested that cooperatives exist usually for one of two reasons. They exist to do something that nobody else wants to do, or they exist to do something that nobody else can do very well. And so if you take a look at rural electrification, for example, mm-hmm. there wasn't a whole lot of money to be made in that. And so these rural cooperatives developed in order to provide a service that the market, the free market, wasn't going to be satisfying. So cooperatives have existed for a long time, primarily because people recognize that they need to cooperate in order to get the goods and services that make their life satisfying.
And one of the things you just said, which is always fascinating about cooperatives, is that as you describe it, as they go in there and they do something that no one else wants to do, when they do something like the electrical cooperative and they get it done, they become wildly valuable because you've just basically done something that was going to be cost ineffective. You've done something there. But once it's done, you've basically set something up to where it's in a desirable quantity. And so there is indefinitely a value within the cooperatives which exists once they accomplish or at least regulate their goal.
Well, yes. And that, getting back to the 1970s and 1980s food co-ops that were around, organic food was was a concept that had been not just talked about, but had been developed on the ground throughout the 20th century. But by the late 1960s, early 1970s, it was widely derided by larger mainstream institutional figures. Earl Butz was Richard Nixon's Secretary of Agriculture, who famously said, well, sure, we could do organic agriculture. You know, we know how to do that. But someone's going to have to decide which are the 50 million people that will die of starvation because organic food is just not productive. Scientists, members of the Department of Agriculture, they were all putting organic agriculture down because it was challenging the status quo. Mm-hmm. Cooperatives, they found organic agriculture. They wanted to promote organic food. And it was really the co-ops, I argue, during the 1970s, 1980s, that demonstrated there is a viable market for this product, that people are willing to pay a little bit extra for food that they feel better about. And the co-ops also helped to create some of those extra organizations, distributors, development corporations, to help each other and to help this market. So I do credit the co-ops in large part for showing that the organic food industry could be viable, that you could actually make a profit out of it.
It does not – there's two things of history which make this in my personal opinion, makes a lot of sense of why this merger happened and why the cooperatives showed the success ratio that they did have. The first was something that happened here in Minneapolis back in 1968, Cub Foods. I mean, and we would go up to northern Minnesota. I lived in Rhode Island. We'd drive out to northern Minnesota. You went to the local Red Owl, I think it was Kozlowski's, and my mom would literally buy out every can of tomato sauce, every can of – I mean, she had a big family. We were there for 3 weeks. She didn't come back into town. It was a very different – grocery stores prior were very different. And all of a sudden you had the rise of the Cub Foods, and which, you know, is turned into Targets and Walmarts, these large corporate grocery store where, yeah, they had a ton of product. But because as you – something you've alluded to and something that the Nixon administration, their ag administration, once they got into this, once they said, OK, well, we have stores that are needing product. We need a, you know, more of a mass production mentality in agriculture. It presented – That the organic, the more healthy ways, the less, you know, the less fertilizer and insecticides being used on the product, those products kind of went to the wayside because you couldn't grow them fast enough to stock those big stores. I mean, there does seem to be a correlation between your book and that historical fact, the rise, the beginning of the big grocery stores.
Yes. And certainly all of this is in the context of that post-World War II era. During World War II, there was a huge challenge of how do we feed millions of troops who are on foreign land, and the rise of mass agriculture, especially preservation techniques. You know, lots of freezing, lots of canning.
Yeah.
Those industries carried over into the 1950s and 1960s, and you know your description of what your mother is buying in the Cub Foods is exactly that. It was canned tomatoes, you know, canned sauce, canned vegetables. The co-ops did emerge in this countercultural moment of the late 60s, early 70s, where the style of the store was also matching how they wanted to run the store. You know, participatory democracy was a very important part of these co-ops at the very beginning. But it also affected what it is that they wanted to sell. So if you just use the term sustainability,
yeah,
you know, what is sustainable for agriculture? What is sustainable for the community? You know, what is sustainable for this small business so that it can stick around for another 6 months or another 6 years? All of those things kind of came together to create something that looked very much not like a Cub.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about this extensively within the book, and starting with the new wave of cooperatives in the 1970s. The other element of history which does not surprise me with cooperatives done so well in Minnesota is I did an interview a few years back with the guy that talked about the rise of the labor unions on the Iron Range, and that the Swedes and the Finns and the Norwegians that came into Minnesota, they brought with them a very socialism style of mentality about you work together in the community. And it took hold throughout all of Minnesota, really, especially as I think you're talking about one of your charts here. In the 1920s, Minnesota had the most cooperative societies. In the 1930s, Minnesota had the most cooperative societies. That was right in line with that historical point. Was there a moment where they realized, okay, we're moving away from health? I mean, I know you refer to points where people were concerned about insecticides, DDT. Stuff like that, and that there was cooperatives were making ads that they were running. They were saying, "Hey, you know, you can buy fruit affordably that doesn't have this." And was there a specific moment, or do you think it just was that okay, I'm just not as comfortable with products that basically I don't know what's gone into them, that started to change in the 70s with the co-ops?
I think that for a long time there has been a sizable group of people that were very concerned about what it is that they were ingesting, but also how it is that we were treating the earth in terms of, you know, industrial pollution or agriculture. It is important to remember that these co-ops that started in the early 1970s, they were rather small. They would get a corner store to operate, but a lot of them didn't have coolers at the very beginning. It was a lot of bulk food, in part because the organic food market was very small at the time. So you might have a few dozen people that were starting up a co-op, and they would have to be finding a farmer to, say, raise a pig or a cow organically, or they would need to find the small distributor that could supply them with their bulk foods. The co-ops and organic food, they kind of grew up together during the 1970s, 1980s as perhaps, you know, proof of concept models were actually coming into play, that we could expand this, that there would be more people that would be interested. But a big part of the co-op success, I believe, is that they adhered to several of these principles that had been laid out long before by the Rochdale pioneers, a group of weavers in England. But two principles that stand out to me as I was looking at this history. First, cooperation among cooperatives. The co-ops did not exist in a vacuum. They weren't necessarily competing against each other. There were different co-ops that had different personalities, and there might be some antagonisms across some of the co-ops. But for the most part, they saw that they were a community of cooperatives, and that they had to work together in order to create the infrastructure, to build the distribution networks, to do the things that they wanted to do individually. And a second principle that I think helped sustain this community was education. Co-ops don't simply exist to put money into the bank, or probably more likely in their case, into the credit union. But they also want to educate their workers and educate their consumers. Mm-hmm. And this process of education was about the participatory democracy model of cooperatives, but it was also about the products that they were selling. So they would bring in farmers. They would do retreats out in agricultural areas. And if you take a look at any of the photos of the old bulletin boards of these co-ops, they were discovering, rediscovering, you know, promoting different ways of eating, of cooking, of thinking, and of running a store all the time. Mm-hmm. So I think that those two principles really set this group of of organizations apart, cooperation among cooperatives, and education.
Well, and it clearly the impact is shown today with the variety that we have that, you know, by inspiring and encouraging people, they basically have revolutionized a lot in the grocery industry. But you brought up cooperation. I don't want to get too much into this because this book has got some very interesting elements of, I don't want to call it a war, but there definitely was a lot of conflict in the 70s between some of these co-ops and organizations as they started to gain some traction.
It is a period that has been popularly known as the co-op wars. Mm-hmm. This is in the winter of 1975 going into the spring of 1976. It is a fascinating period of history for those who have never heard about it. And I will give a little shout out to two of my colleagues who are out there in the world. Craig Cox wrote a work called Storefront Revolution that really dives into what was going on in the co-op wars at that time. And Eric Essie is a contemporary scholar who's been working on a documentary about the co-op wars, and that should be coming out in the next year. The co-op wars, it was significant because you had the co-ops gaining enough strength, enough presence that people started to wonder, how can we go beyond this? The co-ops really did start as a force for social change. And by the winter of 1975, it became apparent that there were two groups of people that were thinking about change in very different ways. An easy way of thinking about it is, if you want to change society, where do you start? Mm-hmm. Do you start with the structure of society? Do you have to change the laws? Do you have to change the economic system? Do you have to change those power relationships? Or if you want to change society, do you have to start with the culture? Do you have to change the values, the ideals that people have? And that's part of what I think was taking place in the co-op wars in 1975-76. There were some who said, we need to change the economic system. We need to perhaps at an extreme, smash the state. And there were others that said, no, we need to change the way that people are approaching the food that they are eating, you know, and the meaning that it has for them. Mm-hmm. So it was during the co-op wars that I think that it did get resolved on the side of the co-ops exist to promote healthy, natural, organic food, to help people rethink what their place is in the world. And to be quite honest, the co-ops after that time became a little less overtly political.
Mm-hmm.
That has benefits and deficiencies, of course. But one of the benefits was it became a lot more easier to sell the idea of a cooperative to places in outstate Minnesota, to these smaller towns that did, you know, as you were mentioning, have some experience with co-ops from the 1920s, you know, or the 1940s. But might have been a little bit more wary of all the anti-war protesting that was being associated with co-ops at the time.
It's funny because as you say that, I go over the Iron Range, two of the best stores I know up there are co-ops, and they're wildly popular. So it definitely has changed. And, you know, whether or not that was just a smart business move or just the focus, you know, was far more on the other product, they've been successful. And it is actually, I'm glad to see the rise of the co-ops again because they do provide a service here. I'll save the rest of it. Read the book. I mean, go over, you can find the book, University of Minnesota Press, as well as also Next Chapter Books. They're going to have this book. Read those chapters because it's very interesting, the conflict that arose in 75-76. Craig B. Upright, the book, Grocery Activism, The Radical History of Food Cooperatives in Minnesota. Craig, I appreciate the time. Thank you so very much. All my best.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. We'll take a break. Matt McNeil right here on AM 950.